This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, why didn't Pistol Pete ever win? Welcome to Over and Back. We are brought to you today by Fast Break Breakfast. Fast Break Breakfast is a podcast for serious NBA fans that is incredibly not serious. Check out what happens when you get two musicians and a comic who are overeducated, underemployed, but share an obsession about the NBA, 90s movies, and conspiracy theories. So make sure you subscribe to Fast Break Breakfast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcast, or check it out at The Step Back. Hello, and welcome back to Over and Back. I am Jason, and with me is a very special guest. He is a writer for Hawks.com, and he also is the host of the new podcast, ATL and 29, Kale Chouinard. Kale, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here.
So we are going to talk about Pistol Pete Maravich, one of the great players of the 1970s, and obviously one of the icons of the game during the time, really one of the tremendously popular players in the league during the 70s. But despite his popularity, it came with a lot of difficulty in his life and in his career, and also in terms of lack of team success. And we're going to kind of get into all of that, the great and the difficult in his life and in his career. You know, when he came out of LSU, had averaged 44 points per game for his final season, was just, you know, it's hard to overestimate what a powerful force he was in college basketball in terms of popularity. And coming to a Hawks team in 1970 that has just moved to Atlanta, has been a successful team, but is also one of the first NBA team that is almost exclusively African-American. And it lacked, despite its success, it did not draw well in St. Louis, forcing the move to one of the reasons why they moved to Atlanta. First, I guess we'll talk a little bit about just, you know, how the legend of Maravich in terms of, you know, where he stood in college basketball heading into the pros in 1970.
I mean, he was it. I mean, he was the TV star. You know, he was one of the people that made basketball marketable on TV. There weren't a whole lot of broadcasts for the NBA or college basketball, probably more for college basketball than the NBA at that point. But, you know, he was one of the people that could actually get, you know, some eyeballs on the TV screen. And so, coming into Atlanta, he was a big draw. Like you said, the Hawks were primarily an African American team in 1970, and that was a big change from where they were a few years earlier. The Pettit teams, playing in St. Louis, that was primarily a white team in a white environment that was, you know, particularly hard for some of the African Americans to visit at that time. And so, you know, they moved to Atlanta. I mean, it was basically a promotional deal, just because I think if you look at the Hawks move, you know, the idea was, you know, to have some sort of downtown attraction, you know, to make Atlanta, you know, a prime American city. It wasn't It wasn't the Atlanta of 7 million people that it is right now. And so, you know, they were trying to sort of, you know, put the downtown on the map, so to speak, and put something there that was marketable entertainment. There wasn't as much then. And it didn't go over that great. You know, the first couple of seasons, the team was good. Ticket sales were not good. This just wasn't really a basketball town to begin with. I mean, it still isn't a basketball town. It's a college football town. College football is king by a large stretch. It's true now, and it was true 45 years ago. And so, you know, I think the biggest thing, though, even underlying all of that, was more so just that because he was the TV star and because money was tight, you know, it was an interesting economic dynamic with his teammates. You know, it wasn't like the NBA of now where you don't have rookies coming in and making substantially more than the star players. That doesn't happen. It's sort of like, you know, what happened with Maravich was basically if you had a successful team of a bunch of guys making, you know, around the mid-level exception, and all of a sudden you bring in a rookie who's making a max contract, you know, that dynamic is problematic, not so much on the, you know, the sociological levels, but on the economic levels. It was, you know, you have a bunch of men who have egos, not ego problems, but just, you know, they have a certain amount of pride in their craft and they've spent their careers doing it. They were successful. You know, they won 48 games 2 years in a row, had done well in the Western Conference. And, you know, they thought they had a pretty successful team. And, you know, all of a sudden you're bringing in a young player who hadn't done a lick in the NBA. And he was making so much more than what they were making. And so that's just, you know, that's a topsy-turvy dynamic that was fraught with problems from the start.
Yeah, and they had already lost, you know, Lenny Wilkins for financial reasons. Zelmo Beatty had gone to the ABA for financial reasons. Joe Caldwell and Bill Bridges are still on the team. Bill Bridges is the captain. And Caldwell and Bridges aren't that well-known today, but they're, you know, very excellent really good role players. I mean, Caldwell was a star player, but more of in the vein of not necessarily like a go-to scorer, but just a guy who was solid in every respect and could score and could do just about everything as well. And he was a guy who really wanted a new contract and felt like, you know, he should be paid as much as this rookie, you know, is being paid. I mean, yeah, he understood the reality of the situation, but he also felt like, hey, you know, it's my turn. I've waited my turn, and I deserve a new contract, and eventually ends up going to the ABA. Now the Hawks still have Lew Hudson, Walt Bellamy, Walt Hazard. So they still have some pretty good talent, but the chemistry is definitely not there to begin with. And part of that is just Maravich is such a unique, remarkable talent in the way that he, you know, that he handled the ball, the way that he shot, the amount that he shot. I mean, the kind of awe that he inspired in people, you know, it reminds me a little bit of how, you know, people have gone crazy over Steph Curry in the last couple of seasons just because of the, you know, the amazing three-point shooting, the amazing ball handling, the skill that he has. Maravich doesn't compare in his effectiveness, although he was obviously a star of his time. But when it just comes to the way that his skills, you know, amazed people, I do think there are quite a few similarities. But the issue was that, and this really went back to Maravich's college and high school careers, that those skills never really made him a difficult player to play with.
Right. I mean, he was a superlative individual talent, but he really didn't have a great track record of, you know, taking those talents and translating them into any sort of team success. And so, you know, you look at the composition of the roster for the Hawks at that point, and they, you know, they had a scorer, they had scoring, they had, you know, they had Lew Hudson, who was a primetime NBA scorer at that point in his career. And so they didn't really need somebody to come in and take a bunch of shots. That wasn't really something that was going to necessarily make them a better team. And so, yeah, that dynamic was also awkward.
Yeah.
And, I, you know, just a couple other things getting way off track, but he had a car phone, right?
Yes.
I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to imagine, you know, finding out that your hotshot rookie teammate has a car phone at that era when that really wasn't a thing. Imagine the first time he showed that to his teammates that inspired some interesting discussions or jealousies. And also, you know, the other thing that you, when you talk about Joe Caldwell that kind of slips into all of that is that, you know, another reality of just the overall basketball leagues at that point, you know, in addition to the fact that a rookie could come in and make so much more than the veteran teammates are already there, the other aspect is there was this competition between leagues.
Right.
You know, the ABA existed. And so that changes the dynamic entirely because then it becomes, you know, an arms race to get the top tier talents.
Yeah, and these players, you know, for the first time, you know, the last 2 years before this, finally have some leverage to actually make some real money. Free agency isn't a thing yet. We're in the era of the reserve clause where a player is basically tied to his team until his team doesn't want him anymore. So, yeah, this creates a, you know, a completely new dynamic. Caldwell was one of the first to, among the first, along with Rick Barry and Zelma Beatty, to jump leagues and actually, you know, take advantage of that. He was definitely a missing piece for this team because he was definitely a glue guy that held the team together. And they went from 48 wins the previous season to 36 wins with Maravich really taking too many shots, making mistakes, just not fitting in with the style of the team and the things that he was good at, as you mentioned. The Hawks already had. Walt Hazard was a similar player. Hudson, you know, was a go-to scorer. They really, you know, on the court, he was not really, you know, providing much that they didn't already have. And also he was, detracting from what they had lost. So it was a tough position for him and for the team, obviously. Another thing is that, you know, Maravich had been molded into this basketball prodigy, this million-dollar player by his father, Press Maravich, who was a player in the barnstorming days, and then in the very early days of pro basketball. I played very briefly in the BAA just a few years before the NBA merged, and then had been a successful college coach and was very well respected. You know, John Wooden considered him, you know, the most brilliant basketball mind in the country. Yet he molded his son in this very obsessive, compulsive way of, you know, demanding that he work on, you know, all of these things, all of these dribbling drills, all of these, you know, all of these over the top things, and just, you know, molding him in that way. And then the team, and he would almost always be his coach, and then forcing the teams around him. So, you know, Maravich didn't really ever get this necessary, you know, basket on court and social skills in order to be able to share the ball and share the spotlight. And you'd probably deal with the locker room dynamics that you would need to have when you're put in that situation.
Yeah, I agree. It's almost like he was, you know, before his time. You know, I think if you watch, you know, video of the games that were being played in that era, you know, his skills leap off the screen. But at the same time, you watch those games and you think, well, you don't really even need some of those skills. You probably, you know, those same skills would be wonderfully useful now against, you know, better, more sophisticated defenses with better athletes. But in those particular contexts, it just seemed like almost like an unnecessary risk to be doing some of the things that he did.
So during that season, the Hawks had 5 national TV games. They actually outdrew the New York Knicks on the road in the Clyde Frazier-Willis-Reed Knicks. Attendance at home was up 20%. Revenue was up 50%. And the new arena, the Omni, was approved all during that time. And the Hawks owner, Tom Cousins, was a real estate developer, was, part of that development, so stood to make a lot of money, you know, on the team and on the arena. And that, and pretty much the reason that that was built was, you know, was Pete Maravich coming into the team. So, you know, the lack of on-court success was there, but just the, you know, tremendous change in business that he, you know, and all the attention that he brought from that was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine the feelings of some of his teammates when they market the team as the new Hawks, you know, coming off of three, if you count the last season in St. Louis, you know, a bunch of successful seasons in a row headed into that season. But, you know, one thing that I don't think anybody could argue with is that those blue and green uniforms are just marvelous.
they are nice, yes.
Aren't they just fantastic? Those are coming back this season, and I'm so excited.
Yeah, those are pretty great. Yeah, it's hard to believe they only had those, I think, 2 years, or was it 3 years? It was not very long. Yeah.
I can't remember for sure. I just know that it started the season that Maravich came in. I'm not sure how long it lasted.
Yeah.
It
was not long.
those are just fantastic. I love that look.
Yeah, they are pretty cool. I mean, the Hawks have it's interesting because the Hawks have had some really great looks and some really bad looks over the years. It's and they're all very different from each other. They have sort of, you know, shifted identities many different times over the year, but they do have some very iconic ones. Obviously, the 80s ones as well, and the early 70s ones are pretty great. I'm not a big fan of the full lime green ones, but the ones with the, you know, the dark blue with the lime accents, I think, are just about perfect.
Yeah, I think those are the only ones. You know, if you look, they do have a long history of wide and varied choices. But I think, you know, red has been a constant through all the uniform choices, except for those ones from the early Maravich years.
Yes, exactly. So his second season, he did improve somewhat at the end of the first season, and you know, he did average 23 points that season, so it wasn't like he was a disaster or anything. But the second season, he dealt with illness early in the season and went from 205 to 168 pounds. Like, dealt with this mystery ailment for quite a while. They thought it was mono, and they thought it was other things, and it was hard to get the team going. They traded Bill Bridges to Philly, so it's very much now Maravich and Hudson as the primary, you know, are the primary stars with Bellamy there as well. But it took a while. It took really like another year or so into 73. Cotton Fitzsimmons replaces Richie Guerin as the coach, and Pat Williams comes in as general manager, who would later build some of the great 76ers teams. And it's sort of a time for Hudson and Maravich to really become quite a incredible scoring tandem. The best that his Hawks tenure would get was probably the 70.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they had a lot of options to score, but they just seemed like they needed a lot of everything else. You know, they didn't. That if you look at the sort of the bell curve of rebounding totals, you know, that seemed like, you know, the early 70s NBA, you know, you routinely see these guys averaging, you know, 14, 15 rebounds a game, and that wasn't like that out of the normal. You know, Bellamy got sort of up there, but not really, and there really weren't that many other guys getting very many rebounds for them at all. So you had to figure that they were kind of getting killed on the glass. And maybe, you know, Maravich wasn't the most efficient scorer. Maybe he would have been had there been a three-point shot or something at the time. But, you know, for a guy who's only, you know, in the low 40s, that's not really maximizing the best of what you've got there.
Yes, they were in 73, they were ninth in out of 17 in offensive rating and ninth out of 17 in defensive rating. And they both equaled 98. They were almost exactly, even in scoring throughout the entire season. So can you talk a little bit about how important Lou Hudson was to the Hawks during these times? Because he was, you know, really the other star of the time for the Hawks. And really another guy who, you know, probably doesn't really get his due. I was very surprised recently to learn that he's not in the Hall of Fame, and he seems like he is a pretty strong candidate to be a Hall of Famer. But, you know, it kind of gets lost a little bit in that during his prime, he was not necessarily the most popular time in the league and not necessarily the most popular team either.
Yeah, last year I talked to Jim Washington, who's a retired player who was a power forward on you know, a few of the teams that had both Maravich and Hudson. And, you know, he's one of the people that, you know, has sort of behind the scenes, he's still sort of lobbying, you know, the I want to say the Veterans Committee, if that's not the right name, but the, you know, the Veterans Committee of the Hall of Fame to try to get Hudson, you know, into the Hall of Fame. But, you know, the way he described Hudson's game to me is, you know, he described him as a scorer, but, you know, one of those guys who really scored a lot, you know, through his jump shot. He wasn't the flashiest player. He was just, you know, one of those players who was just, you know, magnificently accurate with, you know, a jump shot that almost bordered a little bit on being a set shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, he used that to put up some, you know, some pretty prolific scoring totals.
Yeah. KL shared a portion of that Jim Washington interview with me. Washington, he was a power forward on the Hawks for the early 70s. So here is Jim Washington talking about Lou Hudson and Pete Maravich.
A lot of people talk about his relationship with Pete, but because, you know, Pete came with a lot of press.
Sure.
And I think the team saw him, you know, Lou was the man.
Right.
When Pete came here. And I he wasn't going to take a second seat to anybody.
Right.
But there wasn't any animosity.
Right.
You know, there. I mean, we were all, you know, we didn't win any basketball games, but we were all good friends.
Shoot. Yeah, in 73, Hudson averaged 27.1 points per game and 6.2 rebounds. Maravich at 26.1 points per game, 6.9 assists. So both very prolific in scoring that year. And they were not, I mean, they were not necessarily like the most, a extremely fast-paced team during that. I mean, they were fourth in the league in pace. So they were, you know, it was obviously a faster era than today, but was not, those point totals are not extremely inflated by pace, is what I'm trying to say. So,
right. They weren't necessarily like you said, they weren't really a run and gun team. It was, you know, a little bit more methodical half court offense. And, you know, it was, you know, Hudson just being really accurate with his outside shot. He made a couple of all-star games before Maravich got into the fold, and he continued to make some all-star games afterward, and then totally made six straight all-star games. And he was using that jump shot really effectively. He didn't shoot worse than 47% in any of those six all-star seasons.
Yeah, yeah, he was really, you know, quite a weapon offensively. And like I said, just I was surprised that he was not in the that he's not in the Hall of Fame. Hopefully that changes, because he's definitely up there in terms of guys who deserve to be there. So 74, things take a little bit of a turn for the worse for Maravich. Eventually deals with some of the demons that are plaguing him. There's a lot of injuries that season to Herm Gillian, to Hudson, and to Bellamy. Maravich himself eventually is suspended for excessive drinking after a game. Alcohol would be an issue for him throughout his career and in his life until later on, when he became a born-again Christian and gave up alcohol. Eventually Pete requests a trade, although initially apparently there are no takers to the team. But eventually the almost perfect situation opens up for him, is the New Orleans expansion team is interested in him. They do not have a name yet. They, of course, it would eventually be named the Jazz. And the trade was incredibly unequal. I mean, like, the Hawks got, I think, 4 draft picks out of it, and just, you know, it was really a, you know, the Jazz gave up basically every resource they had to get Maravich, who obviously, you know, was this is near where he went to college, and he's, you know, still a tremendous draw, so it made a level of sense for him. But for basketball things, for a, you know, a weak team to give up that much to add a player who was very good but not necessarily going to bring a whole lot of winning was an interesting decision, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of parallels between sort of the Pete Start in New Orleans and Pete Start in Atlanta. You know, you're looking at it from a marketing perspective. You know, you're trying to sell basketball in a place where basketball isn't necessarily the peak sport, especially pro basketball as opposed to college basketball. And so, you know, he's trying to sell it in the Deep South. He's trying to sell it in the state where he's already marketable because of his college career. So it's almost more of a business transaction than a basketball transaction because, again, you know, taking it in the context of the time, you know, the NBA hadn't really established itself as the, you know, monopoly of you know, sports basketball entertainment that it is now. I mean, it didn't have the unbelievable foothold then that it does now.
Yeah, the teams had to make those decisions. They have to be cognizant of those realities even today, but especially at that point. No question about that. Personal tragedy for Pete before the season. His mother commits suicide with their 8-year-old granddaughter, who they were raising as their daughter in the house, and he goes AWOL before an exhibition game in Chicago a few days later, and deals with already had been dealing with depression and exhaustion and some reckless behavior, including, you know, driving 100 miles per hour in a Porsche on city streets and things like that. So there were already going through some challenges, and that obviously added to it. And the team starts off 4-34. And Pete feuds with coach Butch Van Breedlikhoff, who was no stranger to feuding with superstars. And they did start to play better as the season went along, finished 18-17. And there was some optimism over the next few seasons as the Jazz started to have some level of success, particularly in the 77 season. They add Gail Goodrich, and Maravich starts to play pretty well, especially after Elgin Baylor becomes coach during that time. He had made all NBA first team in 76, and really 77, he has quite a tremendous season there playing for Elgin Baylor. Baylor was sort of the first coach after his father that he had really started to have a pretty good amount of respect for, and had, you know, was play kind of made the game fun for him. And I guess it was a matter of, you know, he saw Elgin obviously as, you know, the great player that he was, and felt like he could respect playing for him, where with the other coaches there wasn't that same level of connection. It also may have been partly that Baylor was a little bit more lax than some of his other coaches and was willing to let Pete kind of do what he wanted. But that season he averaged 31.1 points, 5.1 rebounds, 5.4 assists, and shot 43% from the field, which for the time not too bad of a shooting percentage. So February 25th, 1977, he scored his career high of 68 points, taking on the New York Knicks, who had sort of vexed him earlier in his career.
Yeah, I mean, if it was ideal for, you know, somebody who was as much of a solo artist as Maravich was, but if you look at the rosters of those New Orleans Jazz teams until Goodrich arrives on the scene, it's complete no names. I mean, no offense if any of the former members of the Jazz are listening here, but some of those teams are just dreadful. I mean, they're just people, you know, who are out of the league in 4 years, names you would never recognize. There was just not a lot of talent on any of those rosters at all.
Yeah, or a bunch of, or if there were names, they were guys who had been, you know, who were about to get out of the league, you know, who were way past their prime, that sort of thing. Yeah, and then, you know, Goodrich gets hurt very early on as he comes along, so the team, right, you know, despite that momentum, is unable to have a whole lot of success. But he ends up leading the league in scoring that year.
Yeah, and you know, it's good that Goodrich is there, but at the same time, that trade ends up being a disaster.
Yes, yeah, ends up the Lakers get the draft pick that becomes Magic Johnson out of that deal. So obviously a huge disaster for the team. 78, things start to potentially look like they're going to go better. There's a new GM is brought in, and Chuck Robinson is signed as a free agent, actually coming from Atlanta. He had played in Washington and then came from Atlanta and then came to the Jazz, and he was really a stout rebounder, had had his peak season by far that year, 22 points and 15 rebounds, but Maravich still has 27 points, still a pretty strong season for there. Actually get a couple of okay players, Aaron James and Rich Kelly, who aren't that well known now, actually play pretty well for the team. And the team starts drawing, and it looks like they might make the playoffs. So they were playing in the Superdome, which is sort of an odd environment, of course, because of how big it is. But they started to draw crowds of more than 30,000 on occasion and talked about getting 40,000 in the playoffs. So they were 24-24 when Pete goes down with injures his knee ligament with a jumping behind the back pass. And at that point, the team falls apart. And even though he tries to return with a knee brace, he can't do much. And that basically ends the potential for the Jazz, both in New Orleans, and ends the potential for Maravich to be able to ends his physical prime in any case, where, you know, after that, he is dealing with injuries and other ailments that kind of prevent him from really ever being a great player again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a few years later when he retired, that knee injury was still sort of an issue for him.
Also, there are some chemistry issues between him and Chuck Robinson, some resentment over salary, and the 79 season goes very poorly. They're 26 and 56 that year. The Jazz moved to Utah the following season, and Maravich is there for a handful of games, but is basically at the point where the management is trying to force him out. He's out of shape for the first time in his career. His playing time is drastically reduced, and eventually they start 2-19, and he's held out of a game with the Lakers, which would have been his first opportunity to battle Magic Johnson, which actually they were looking to draw a big crowd for that game, and then when that didn't happen, it disappointed a lot of people. But eventually released, he is wooed by the 76ers and the Celtics. It seems likely that he's going to pick Philly, but then ends up going with Boston instead.
If you know, sort of leading up to that release, you know, you've finally got a Jazz team that has some talent on it. You know, you've got, you know, guys like Matt Calvin and Ron Boone, you know, some veterans that know how to play, and you've got a young player in Adrian Dantley who, you know, is about to blossom into one of the league's best scorers. And so you can kind of see that, you know, there really wasn't a role there. So, you know, if you have a coach that doesn't agree with Maravich's style of play, you know, he's got an excuse to do that type of a shelving, because finally, you know, the Jazz after the move have a roster that's worth watching at least a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. But they did struggle that year, and Boone, you know, was pretty close to the end there. They also had Bernard King for 19 games, but he had a bunch of legal issues that, you know, prevented it. He eventually ended up going to Golden State and eventually reviving his career there, and then, of course, going to New York. But the talent, you know, there certainly were pieces there, but it was kind of a situation where no one was right at the right point of their career to really be able to make them an effective team. And it took a while for them. It took a couple years for them to kind of start getting pretty good. And once Frank Layden comes along and Dantley really develops into a star, they and Mark Eaton's there, and, you know, they start to you get pretty good, and then of course start transitioning into the Stockton Malone era just a couple seasons after that. But yeah. that's a very weird team on paper for sure.
It is a weird team, and you're right. There wasn't a lot of success, but yeah, it was quite an interesting roster.
Yes, for sure. So going to the Celtics, this is the rookie season for Larry Bird, and this allows Maravich to be on a dominant team for the first time. The Celtics are 61-21. Maravich has to get into shape during the season and sort of slowly works his way into the team. Has a game of 31 points against the Pacers, becomes more of a regular player later in the season. The team has, in addition to Bird, they also have Tiny Archibald, Dave Cowens, ML Carr, who was a huge Pistol Pete fan, Cedric Maxwell. You know, things go pretty well there, although he does become Bill Fitch's favorite whipping boy, which leads to resentment later.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird roster. You know, one of the forgotten things about the Celtics of Bird's era is that they weren't really very deep at guard in the early years. You know, the first three, four, almost about 4 years until about 83, there really wasn't a whole lot of deep guard talent on those Celtics rosters. And so there was an opportunity for Maravich to come in and play a little bit. And, you know, Auerbach was just one of those people who was always fascinated with Maravich's skill set. You know, he was always, you know, I think one of the things at the time was, you know, when they would do the national NBA broadcasts, you know, they'd intersperse it with different clips of, you know, Red basically explaining basketball. Again, you know, basketball wasn't big on TV at the time. And so, you know, they'd put him on TV, you know, explaining the pick and roll, or that have people on there playing a game of horse. And, you know, if Red was the one that was hosting, you know, Maravich was one of his favorite subjects.
There are some good ones with Maravich in there and showing the, you know, the ability to dribble like through his legs and, you know, like around his back and like not just, you know, the normal dribbling through his legs, but also like basically, you know, dribbling with both hands and being able to through his legs and then being able to catch it like behind him, which is just amazing. You know, the amazing ability, the hand-eye coordination and the ball control and all of that, all of those skills that are hard to describe are, I mean, there's a lot of places that showcase that you can see, you know, with game highlights, but I think the I think even the Red on Round Ball segments demonstrate that even further.
Right, and it was this strange mix. It's like marketing, but in a strange way. It's like half educational and then half just, hey, gee whiz, here's what this guy can do.
Yeah, which is cool. I mean, it's a little bit, it's old-fashioned, but like in a fun way. I mean, it's a little corny, but like in a good way. You know, it's redeeming for sure. Yeah, the other guards on the team, it's sort of an odd mix. Chris Ford and Jarrod Henderson, who's very young on that team, and Don Chaney right at the end of his career as well. He'd been a Celtics legend for a long time. So, didn't really have, other than Archibald, who was still kind of coming back from injury at that point, they didn't really have they didn't necessarily have the best backup in the world. So, Maravich, like I said, did fill in pretty well. But once the playoffs came along, didn't really didn't contribute much. He only played 13 minutes in the entire series against Philly in six games that they lost. So I think was frustrated over that, but was looking to come back to the team, actually really got into great shape over the summer and played well in camp, but he felt buried by Fitch. And there was an incident where basically ML Carr, was goofing around and kicked the ball, and Fitch didn't see it, but then blamed Maravich for it. And when Carr went to step up to accept the blame, Maravich just signaled to him just not to say anything, and he took the tongue lashing from Fitch. And then the next day, he didn't show up for practice, and then decided to retire. Also, felt his pride was being damaged from coming off the bench. And that story is from the great book Pistol by Mark Kriegel, which I highly recommend. One of my favorite NBA biographies of all time. Got a chance to actually listen to the audiobook version of it this summer. I listened to it twice because it was so good. So highly recommend. A lot of great stuff on Pete's career in that. But
yeah, I agree. And that's a terrific book. And so yeah, Maravich, you know, he had a good summer. He shot almost 50% with the Celtics the year before. This is you know, one season into the 3-point era.
Right.
So he had a chance to try it out. He didn't take that many 3-pointers, but maybe you know, coming off of that a season of trying it, maybe he was going to try it more the next year. And he had a contract. He had a, you know, like you said, a good summer working out, came in fit. And
he's 32. He wasn't ancient. I mean, that was a more retirement age in 1980, but still, he in theory may have had a few years left.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you had this strange training camp for the Celtics in the summer of 1980. You know, I guess this is right around the time of the U.S. boycotting the Moscow Olympics, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so the Celtics, you know, they make that trade with Golden State, and they trade the number one pick to Golden State, and they draft McHale, who didn't come over didn't sign right away, and was, you know, at least in theory, plotting to play in Italy. And maybe that was a contract ploy. I'm guessing it was a contract ploy.
Right.
But, you know, you've got Parrish in camp, and he's, you know, he's not the Robert Parrish of the Celtics at that point. He's more of the Robert Parrish of the Warriors. And I think, like Maravich, Parrish was kind of a whipping boy for Fitch. And, you know, you've got Dave Cowens. So, you know, all in total, the Celtics have six future Hall of Famers in this camp. You've got Bird, Parrish, McHale, Maravich. I've lost track. You got Archibald.
Yeah.
And Cowens. I don't think I said Cowens yet.
Right.
And so Cowens is, you know, by the time everybody's in camp and stuff, Cowens is feeling sort of overwhelmed by the sheer talent, and probably not knowing how good the talent was. He's probably thinking, you know, here's a journeyman from Golden State and a rookie kicking my butt. And, you know, it turns out that it's not really just a journeyman and a rookie. It's Parrish and McHale.
Right.
So he has this super frustrating training camp, and, you know, one day just gets on the team bus and says, I'm done. And, you know, that's, you know, just a couple of weeks after what you say, which is this strange incident between, you know, Fitch, Carr, and Maravich, you know, where Carr kicks the ball and Maravich gets the brunt of it and gets ticked off, and soon after he's retiring. So, you know, in a span of 2 weeks, the Celtics, you know, lost two 32-year-old future Hall of Famers. And, you know, it seems like both would have had a little bit more left, but there's just this strange hot brew of a training camp, and they just kind of got overwhelmed with the experience. And of course, you've got Fitch in the mix, who's, you know, a great coach, but also a noted hothead.
Right. Yeah. Well, things worked out pretty well for the Celtics either way, but.
And they won a championship.
Yeah. Right.
So I guess it worked out in the end, but.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, a little drama doesn't hurt a team. You know, look at the Cavs last year. You know, they, you know, sometimes a little drama just brings everybody together.
Yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes. That is really interesting. And Cowens, the funny thing about Cowens is two funny things. One is that he had actually, I think in 77, had retired for like 2 months during that season, became a cab driver, just, you know, felt like his heart wasn't in the game for a little bit. And then of course, came back to the team and stayed for, you know, another few seasons. And then he did actually come back and played with the Bucks. It was 83 season. He played, retired for 2 seasons, then came back. That's right.
It was like half a season.
Right.
And it was with the Bucks. You know, it was Don Nelson basically begged him out of retirement.
Right.
You know, I think he played more power forward than center for the first time in his career, if that distinction was there, just because I think he was playing a lot with Lanier.
Yeah.
And he played like half the season. I think he ended up getting hurt before the postseason, so I don't think he played in the postseason. But then that Bucks team did sweep the Celtics.
Yeah. Which is another one of those weird, like, oh yeah, the Bucks swept the Celtics. Like, that was just a really weird, random Celtics season. Of course, I don't think anybody was beating the Sixers that year, but still, quite a random occurrence. Kind of a forgotten season for the Celtics.
Yeah, and it kind of, you know, we're getting far field of Maravich here, but it ties back to two things we mentioned before, which was that, you know, Fitch was a noted hothead, so that was sort of the end of Fitch's reign when people that, you know, the Celtics people on the Celtics roster had really just had enough of him. And I think that was, you know, again, the series where just the lack of guard depth really just crushed them.
Yeah, absolutely. So anything else that we should talk about when it comes to Maravich?
You know, I don't think so. One thing that I was going to say that never really got worked in is just, you know, when I was talking to Jim Washington, who was on those teams, you know, one of the things that he pointed out was that, you know, there was always sort of the unofficial racial quotas of the time. You know, when the game was first integrated, you know, the teams would have one or two black players. And, you know, if you go to the era where Maravich first comes to the Hawks, you know, it's still a setup where, you know, guys were going to be kept on the roster, you know, or I should just say, you know, a couple of the roster spots were going to be reserved for white players. You know, nothing on the record, but that was just the way it was, you know, whether they thought it was, you know, marketing to white fans or whatever, but that was just the reality of what it was. And so when you have to picture Maravich coming to the Hawks, you just have to take it in the context of, again, you know, they were treating Maravich's arrival as, you know, something of a challenge to their own livelihoods.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, why I would feel if I had been a success and then suddenly I'm being shifted, you know, in favor of, you know, of this player who has this wild style who, you know, I have suspicions that I can't play with. And it's because the reason people like him is a lot of the reason why his popularity is fueled by the fact that he's white. That's obviously unfair and unjust. And I would be frustrated by the situation, too, whether, you know, I blamed him or not for it individually. It's still, you can understand everyone's motives involved, but still obviously be just frustrated by the fact that those motivations are unfortunately, you know, felt like they had to be dealt with at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Maravich is just such an interesting character and personality, and definitely worth, like I said, reading that book and watching YouTube clips of him. You know, whether it's the drills or whether it's the highlights of that 68-point game against the Knicks, where he, you know, basically destroys every, you know, Clyde Frazier and Butch Beard, Dean Memminger, Earl Monroe, all those guys. You know, he basically embarrasses. He's really just worth seeking out and worth venturing out. And I really appreciate you coming in to chat about him.
Well, thank you. I appreciated the opportunity.
Before we go, tell us a little bit about your podcast.
Oh, well, I started a podcast, you know, that's going to be sort of an all NBA podcast, but we're going to probably work in, you know, an above average proportion of things related to the Hawks, just because, you know, one, I have access to it, and two, I think some of those things get under discussed in the national media. It's not necessarily the most talked about market in the NBA, and so, you know, try to take advantage of what we have here and look at the whole picture of the NBA, but look at the Hawks a little bit too.
Cool. Well, I enjoyed the first episode, and I'm sure it will be it'll be a great addition to the podcast landscape. So thanks again for coming. Thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us now at The Step Back, our new home. So hopefully you've been enjoying the stuff there. It's been some great stuff from the people who are part of the HP network and also some great people at Fansided. So hopefully you're enjoying that. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcast. Just search for Over and Back. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening, and we're back again soon. We'll be right back.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big money on new windows now at Menards. Update your home with vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows in store or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more window deals happening this week now at Menards.
Save big.